how he had taken his authority, if you like, from the predecessor of Acharyas. We discussed this morning about how he was living in the Radha Damodar Mandir, and during that period in the early 60s, how Srila Rupa, Srila Sanatan, and Jiva Goswamis appeared to him and gave him some instructions about how to write his books, and how his spiritual master, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, was also appearing to him and giving him enthusiasm and the strength, he says, the power to be able to write his books. And Prabhupada himself also, he said several times that actually it's not my writing, it is Krishna's writing. In other words, Prabhupada was just acting as a mouthpiece. So we just got up to that point this morning. We're going to continue on looking at Prabhupada's. This is looking at Prabhupada before he came to the West. So in 1976, April 22nd, Srila Prabhupada was in Melbourne. I will say that the material for this has been drawn. I'm not trying to present everything Prabhupada ever said about his writing. What I'm presenting is material that I personally gathered up when I was traveling with Prabhupada and put it together in such a way that it gives us a glimpse into Prabhupada's writing activities. So it's meant to be a synopsis rather than a complete presentation, but it should give us a good understanding, you know, of what Prabhupada was doing. So on April 22nd, Prabhupada was in Melbourne. Yeah, it was his last visit here, 1976. He came for a week. And we were up in Prabhupada's rooms, there in Prabhupada House. And we were just chatting with Prabhupada and myself and Pushyakrishna Swami. He was Prabhupada's secretary at that time. He had just come onto the party about a month or so before. So we were waiting for some guests to come. And in the meantime, Prabhupada was in a very congenial mood. So we were having a nice, informal, very sweet conversation. And that gave us some opportunity to ask specific questions to Prabhupada and find out more details about his past activities. So I mentioned this morning that in those days, 76, there was no Prabhupada Lilamrita. Yeah, his biography had been written several years after Prabhupada's disappearance. So what we knew about Srila Prabhupada's pre-ISKCON activities was a little scant. We knew some of the significant events. This child has to sign another, put a dummy in his mouth, or, you know, feed him something, or take him outside. Yeah, but I can't compete. So we knew something about Prabhupada's previous activities, but not a lot of detail. So any opportunity that we got in conversation with Prabhupada to somehow or another draw out more details, we were always, of course, naturally happy to do that. So Pushyakrishna Maharaj asked him if many people had come to hear from him before his coming to the West. People were coming, Prabhupada said, but he had no time to visit many places or people because he was busy with his writing. To me, it seemed very significant that Prabhupada had reversed the usual trend. Generally, somebody retires and then dedicates their remaining days to writing. But Prabhupada wrote, and then he came out to teach his writings by practical example. Pushyakrishna added that he didn't think that Krishna consciousness would have had much effect upon people without Prabhupada's personal example. And so Prabhupada modestly agreed. That was the example of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he said, to teach by example. And this is actually why I called this seminar, Srila Prabhupada, the Living Bhagavatam. Because if we'd have just had the books, it would not have had the same effect as Prabhupada being, you know, within our midst, demonstrating all the teachings of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, because he personally lived it, therefore it had a tremendous impact. So Later on, we went to America. From here, we went to New Zealand, we went to Fiji, we went to Hawaii for a month. Then we went to various places in mainland America, Los Angeles, Detroit, Toronto, New Brunswick, Washington, D.C. And we ended up on July 9th, we arrived in New York. And we stayed there for about 10 days. And of course, during that visit, that was the first New York Ratheatra was held, a very big affair. The one place where Prabhupada had begun his teachings, New York, in 1966, but the one place in America where we hadn't yet had a Ratheatra. So in 1976, 10 years, then finally the devotees organized a very, very big Ratheatra right there on Fifth Avenue, and that was a wonderful success. Anyway, so we were there in New York for about 2 weeks, almost, not quite. And on July the 11th, then we received a letter. Prabhupada received a letter from Yasamati Nandana Prabhu, who was preaching in Gujarat, in Ahmedabad. And Prabhupada visited there at the end of 1975. We'd gone for 1 week. Actually, we weren't staying in Ahmedabad, but we had arrived there, and then we went to a town called Sanand. Is anybody from Gujarat here? Yeah? Ahmedabad, or where are you from?
Yeah,
you know Sanand?
Yeah,
just nearby.
Yes.
So we went there. The Maharaj of Sanand, he was a very nice man. He had invited Prabhupada to give some pandal programs there, and we were staying in the palace there. So Yasamani Nandan Prabhu, he's a Gujarati devotee, he's still there, and he was just trying to get the temple going in Ahmedabad. So that was just at the very beginning. We didn't really have our own temple there at that time. Now if you go, we have a very big temple. You know, we built a place here a few years ago. But at this time, they were just living in a rented house. So Yasamani Nandan Prabhu wrote describing a highly successful Ratheatra in Ahmedabad. The local temples had organized it, not ISKCON temples, but just, you know, the local areas. I don't know what to do about this. You have to give the children something to eat or a dummy, yeah? But something to keep them quiet. Thank you. The local temples organized it, and the Mahant of the Jagannath temple had presided over it. The devotees had a kirtan on the back of the truck during the parade, which the whole city populace had witnessed. By simply leaning over the truck's side, they had sold 1,500 of the newly printed Gujarati magazine, Bhagavad Darshan, without even getting off the truck. Yasamali Nandan said that he felt that it was a record for Indian book distribution. At that time, our book distribution in India was very sparse. It was only just beginning. All the book distribution mainly was in America and here in Australia. So he said because they aimed to make sure that everybody got one, then they were only charging 1 rupee each for each magazine. So they only made 20 paisa profit on each magazine. The main thing was to get the message out. Yasamani Nandan's description of how they got to participate in the parade was very interesting. He said, "It was by your direct mercy that we got a place on the truck, because when we met the Mahant of the Jagannath temple, he refused to see us because he thought that we were hippies." And in those days, when the devotees first went to India, yeah, they had a very big impact. And then after some time, this rascal producer, film producer, what was his name, Devon N or something, he came and pretended to be very friendly with the devotees, "Oh, we want to promote you and this and that." Then he made this movie, Dumber the Dumb, which showed, it portrayed the devotees to be all drug addicted hippies. Yeah, so that image was broadcast for a while, and we had to kind of live that down somehow or another. So anyway, this Mahant of the Jagannath temple in Ahmedabad, he had that impression. So he wouldn't see the devotees. So then there was another sadhu who was standing nearby, and he knew your divine grace very well. So he said, you were disciples of Bhaktivedanta Swami? So we said, yes. So then he went to the Mahants and he introduced us. Then the Mahant said, okay, so then you can come on Tuesday and join in the temple truck with a few sadhus of your own. And that's how we got in. So this sadhu's name that introduced us, his name is Narayan Das, and he is the Mahant of the Nilkant Mahadev Ranji Mandir in Badigram. So he said that your divine grace had stayed with him for almost 6 months in his ashram about 15 or 20 years ago. He was very nice, and he said that Swamiji was a great scholar and was giving lectures in the ashram every day. All day he was writing on the Bhagavatam. He was eating only once, and in the evening just taking milk. So, you know, Prabhupada had told us a couple of months before that he wasn't doing very much in the early 60s because he was too busy writing. That was his main occupation. And then we got this letter from Yasunadi Nandan confirming that. They met this sadhu and he said, oh yeah, he was in my ashram. He stayed with me 15, 20 years ago. So that was in the early 60s. And this is what he was doing. He was simply writing the Bhagavatam. So Prabhupada was working very hard to present that. And even though he had only just begun the work, he was already advertising the Srimad Bhagavatam in 60 volumes. Yeah. he hadn't even published one volume, but he was already advertising 60 volumes. And at that time, of course, he was already in his mid-60s when he began the work. So you can see Prabhupada had a very optimistic view of his preaching work. So, anyway, that was... Apparently Prabhupada was writing during the daytime, because that was his main occupation. But later on, when he came to the West, he had to change his schedule. ISKCON, you know, more or less formed within a year of his arrival. And then as soon as, you know, ISKCON began to develop, then Prabhupada's time for writing became less and less and less. Actually, Prabhupada said that ISKCON really took off after 1968. 66 to 68, he got some following. And, you know, they started New York, then they started San Francisco, then there was Montreal, and I think somebody went to Seattle or Santa Fe, like that. So there were about, at the beginning of 68, there was about five or six temples. All of them were in North America. And Prabhupada had about 60 initiated disciples. By 1971, say 4 years later, end of 71, there were 60 temples and there was 500 devotees. So in that period, that 68 through 71, the movement expanded 10 times the size. And Prabhupada then began to travel, you know, internationally. Up until that point he's been in America. But during that period, late 60s, early 70s, Prabhupada went to Europe for the first time. He went to Germany, he went to England, where he stayed with the Beatles, John Lennon, on his estate. They got the preaching going there. He went to Africa for the first time. He came to Australia for the first time. He went to Japan for the first time. He went to Moscow for the first time. And he brought his disciples to India for the first time also, yeah, in 1970. And once he got back to India, everything just was like a phenomenon. And within a couple of weeks, they were running here and there, doing four or five programs a day sometimes. Yeah. Zipping around Bombay and then up to Surat and, you know, Gorakhpur and so many other places. It became a very big thing. And at the same time, Prabhupada got land in Mayapur. Then he got the land donated in Vrindavan. Then he entered into an agreement to buy the land in Bombay. At the same time, he had started ISKCON Press. Then, very shortly after that, ISKCON Press in 1971 became the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust. And he began to publish his own books. So he started up, he got a group of devotees together. He was supervising that. So you can imagine the amount of work that Prabhupada was taking on. It was unbelievable. And at the same time, he was still publishing, he was still writing and still publishing. So he, I think in 68, 69, he did the summary study of the entire Nectar of Devotion. We just call it the Nectar of Devotion. Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. He did the summary study of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, at least one section, teaching the Lord Chaitanya. He also did a summary study of the entire 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam in the form of the Krishna book that came out as a trilogy. And at the same time, he was still writing regularly, you know, his Bhagavatam. And he was supervising also the Bhakti Godhead production. So, where was the time to do all of this? Yeah. And then later on, 1973, he decided Chaitanya Charitamrita also should be published, the biography of Lord Chaitanya. So that by 1975, that came out 17 volumes. So he did all of that, and I mean, just it was, you know, not as he said one. He told George Harrison later in 1976, George had been given one of the new books, Seventh Canto, that had just come out. George was looking through it, and he just said, you know, this is just unbelievable. He said, I don't know how anybody could write so many books. He said, I can't even read them all. And, you know, Prabhupada was very modest, but he said, yes. He said, actually, for a human being, it is not possible. So, you know, Prabhupada was getting some energy from somewhere, but it wasn't the ordinary human platform. Anyway, so on December the 5th, 1975, Prabhupada was in Sri Vrindavan Dham. And I put this in, I have a book called The Transcendental Diary, which is an account of the time that I spent traveling with Prabhupada on a daily basis. And I have put in one sample day, just to explain what Prabhupada's schedule was. So after a full day, then in the evening, Prabhupada would take a massage. So that usually lasted about a half an hour on average, but sometimes it could go up to 2 hours. So he would generally take rest about 10 o'clock after having had a glass of hot milk. It's interesting that that letter from Yasamani Nanda mentions this man remembered Prabhupada always had a glass of hot milk every evening. And 20 years later, when I was with Prabhupada in 76, he was still having a glass of hot milk every evening. That was always, every night without fail. So he would have his glass of hot milk. At this point, December, early December, it's quite cold in Vrindavan. So Prabhupada's circulation and joints need a bit more attention. And so the massage was going on a little bit longer than usual. I took rest about 11 o'clock. In the evening. Then as we disciples slept, Prabhupada rose up at about 11:30 or midnight to begin his most important work of the day, the translation of the Srimad Bhagavatam and the writing of his transcendental purports. Harikesh, he was on the party as Prabhupada's cook and transcribing Prabhupada's dictations. He is a light sleeper and he often awakens as Prabhupada comes through the servant's room on his way into his darshan room. Rolling over in his sleeping bag, he offers his obeisances as Srila Prabhupada goes past. So, that sometimes happens. Sitting at his desk, Prabhupada chanted japa for an hour or so in complete concentration on the holy names. He prayed to Krishna for the ability to serve him nicely and to present the eternal words of the Srimad Bhagavatam in a manner just suitable for the understanding of the entire world. Conscious that his work will form the basis for law and order in the next 10,000 years. Prabhupada said that at one point. He knew what he was doing. Prabhupada had a sense of history. He knew what he was doing. And he had a good understanding of what the effects will be. Putting aside his japamala, he donned his spectacles and flicked on the desk light. He opened the Bhagavatam and the bookmarks. The green Varanasi edition with the Sanskrit commentaries of previous acharyas, and the red Bengali one with the commentaries by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He leaned forward and studied them intently. The microphone close to his mouth, he flicked on the tape and began his dictation. Srimad Bhagavatam, 7th canto, 7th chapter, verse 25, purport continued. That is actually the verse that he was working on that particular night, because I checked it, I did a bit of research. So that was Prabhupada's regular schedule. He only slept 2 or 3 hours a day, an hour after breakfast, an hour after lunch, and an hour at night time, or maybe an hour and a half. The only time that he changed that a little bit was if he was really sick, then he might take a little extra rest to compensate for that and allow his body to recuperate. But other than that, all through the night, Prabhupada was working on his books. So on June the 18th, 1976, Prabhupada was in Toronto, and some professors had come from the local university. And they were very impressed, you know, with Srila Prabhupada. They were asking him, somehow or another, Prabhupada would send his disciples to attend their philosophy courses and, you know, get their degrees in philosophy. And Prabhupada was in return asking them to use his books as the basis for their philosophy courses. So anyway, always conscious of his mission and aware of the slightest opportunity for preaching, Prabhupada suggested that they should consider his books the texts in their classes, citing the recent orders that we had received from East Germany. So at that point, Ghanashyam Das, who later became Bhaktitirtha Swami, he was in the communist countries behind the Iron Curtain, selling Prabhupada's books in the universities, and he had sent a report from East Germany where he had met with very good success. He was there all along and he was getting orders from all the different universities, so Prabhupada was really happy about that somehow or another, and he was penetrating into these places where you could have been arrested and locked away for life just for having a Bhagavad Gita or something. So one of the professors asked him how long it had taken him to complete the Chaitanya Charitamrita, especially wondering when he found time to write. Prabhupada told him that it took 1.5 years to complete the 17 volumes, and he explained his schedule. I write in the night. I go to bed at 10:30. I get up at 12:30. Then I finish my chanting, if there is any balance. And then I begin dictating. And in the morning, they take it and type it. So this dictaphone is always with me, wherever I go, so that my book writing is not stopped. Maybe a few pages, but something is there daily. Little drops of water wear away the stone. So in that way, we have translated so many books. About 54 books are already published, besides the small booklets. And we have published the Bhagavatam, 22. So I'm expecting 60 volumes. That's the Bhagavatam. 60 volumes of 400 pages. The biggest canto is the 10th canto, and I have already published the 10th canto, summarized, in Krishna. But the detail, it will take at least 20 volumes. Then the 10th canto is almost as big as the rest of the book, his guest observed. Yes, Prabhupada smiled. There are 90 chapters in the 10th canto. All the other cantos, at most, they have 30 chapters, but the 10th canto is 90 chapters. That is Krishna's face, Krishna's beautiful face. Everybody is attracted by the smiling face of Krishna. So that was it. Prabhupada just informed me how he'd written 17 volumes of books all at night time, whilst he was doing everything else, touring, lecturing, managing, you know, the works. So the month later, we got to Bhaktivedanta Manor in London, and Prabhupada had invited George Harrison, who was the donor of that property, to come and see him. George had a lot of faith in Srila Prabhupada. He regarded him as his guru. So he came, they had a nice meeting. Prabhupada was very sick actually when we got to London. He had suffered, he got a heavy cold before we left New York, and then he insisted on flying to London. So on the plane he got extremely sick. And then when we arrived in London, then he spent practically the first 2 or 3 days in bed because he was so weak and he had so much mucus in his system. So when George came, then Prabhupada received him in his bedroom. He was taking rest and I woke him up and he said, bring him in. So we brought George in the bedroom, Prabhupada had him sit down, and then the devotees had cooked you know, a nice feast. So they fed him right there in Prabhupada's bedroom whilst Prabhupada was sitting up in bed chatting with him. So after they finished eating, then Prabhupada asked George if he was reading his books at all. So George said that he was, Man and Krishna. Mukunda gave me the new books, but there's just so much to read. I don't know how anybody could have written it. It's difficult enough to read all that amount. Prabhupada acknowledged his appreciation. Sometimes they are a surprise how one man can write so many books. But it is Krishna's grace, he said humbly. Otherwise, not possible. For a human being, it is not possible. Ranjore Das looked up a verse that Prabhupada had quoted earlier. While George expresses respect for Srila Prabhupada's hard labour. These books are such a lot of work, I don't know how he could have done it all. Gurudas Maharaj explained that Prabhupada translated in the night. And Prabhupada added, at night, I don't sleep. It is not that because nowadays I am sick, but generally, I don't sleep. At most, 2 hours. I think I take a little rest during the daytime. So on the whole, 3-4 hours. But actually, I do not like to sleep. And George empathized. No, it's a waste of time. And Prabhupada said, I think it is. When I go to sleep, I think, now I am going to waste my time. I actually think like that. What is the word for it, George said? They call it little death. Yeah? Sleep is the little death. Prabhupada quoted Prahlad's instructions in the 7th canto, part 2. So here he is estimating, this was the new volume that had just come out. He is estimating that you have got 100 years at most. So out of that, 50 years are lost in sleep. And then 20 years are lost playing as a boy or a child. So he then had me read out all the verses that describe how a materially attached person wastes his entire life of 100 years. George showed some interest in those verses, so Prabhupada gave him that volume of the Bhagavatam too. Anyway, because that conversation was much longer, but I just focused on that little bit there about, you know, the writer and George's appreciation for that. So May 10th, 1976, Prabhupada had gone to Hawaii. And in Hawaii, the arrangement was that he would stay there for 1 month. So the history of that was that 71, 72, 73, you know, and then Prabhupada started working on Chaitanya Charitamrita, 73, 74. He was, you know, producing so much work, translation, that the BBT devotees couldn't keep up. So when Prabhupada arrived in Los Angeles in early 1975, they were about 17 or 18 volumes behind Srila Prabhupada. And that many books that were pending. They were working on the editing, they were working, you know, English editing, Sanskrit editing, Bengali editing, doing the artwork, all these nice paintings that had to go in the books. You know, then there was the composing, type layout, typesetting. You know, it was a big operation. And there were 17 or 18 volumes behind Srila Prabhupada. So Prabhupada naturally wasn't pleased. And he said, actually, I feel discouraged from writing any more. If I'm writing, but you're not printing, then why should I write any more? So he told them, he said, now I'm here for 2 months. I want every volume published in the next 2 months whilst I'm here. So Rameshwar, he was in charge, BBT, and Radha Balabala was the production manager. They just said, they were out on a morning walk. And so they said, but Prabhupada, that's impossible. And Prabhupada, you know, it is impossible is a word in a fool's dictionary. That was all he said. So they immediately, to their credit, they left the morning walk. They went straight back to the Yeah. This is when Prabhupada Guru says something, that's it, you do it, if you're serious. So they went back, they called all the BBT devotees together, and they put everybody on a 24-hour shift system for getting all the books out. By the end of the 2 months, they had, I think, 15 or 16 of the books done, finished, all, you know, off to the printers. Prabhupada was very, very pleased. So anyway, that was 75. Then early 76, when Prabhupada had gone to India for the Golpurnima festival, then after Mayapur, we were in Vrindavan. This was in April of 76. And they were trying to work out what Prabhupada's tour schedule would be for that summer, going to the West. So then Rameshwar was there, and he reminded Prabhupada, he said, actually, he said, we have now caught up with you. Yeah? As you produce a book, as you write the book, we can actually get it to the press within 1 month. So he said, we're only one volume behind you now. So previously you said that if we could catch up with you, you would be more encouraged. So we would like you to spend 1 month in Hawaii and do more writing. And Prabhupada immediately was very happy. He said, yes, we will do that. So we went to Hawaii. We were there the entire month of May. And Prabhupada increased his writing by about 6 or 7 times his normal amount, because there were no visitors coming. It was nice, good situation there, quiet. But still, you know, he put in a lot more effort. There were several evenings, I remember, when Prabhupada called me in, and he was already working. And normally I'll join about 9:30, and you know, Prabhupada would have his rest, I'd give him his massage, and then he would be up by 11:30, and then he would work through the night. A couple of occasions in Hawaii, he called me in at 8 o'clock, you know, 7 o'clock, he was already working, and he told me, no rest tonight, yeah. Done, no massage. And he literally worked the entire night on his books. He finished his 7th canto and started the 8th canto whilst we were in Hawaii. So, you know, tremendous effort that he was putting in. On top of that, Hayagriva Prabhu, he had been out of the movement for a little while. He was one of the very first devotees to join in New York in 66. He was an English professor. And he was the first editor that Prabhupada got in ISKCON. So he worked on Prabhupada's books for a few years, but then he had personal problems. He left, I think, in around 72. Then in 76, he came back. So the BBT sent him to Hawaii to be with Srila Prabhupada and to work on what was then called the philosophy book, Spiritual Dialecticism, which was a Vedic view of Western philosophies. That project had been started, I think, in 71 in India, when Chandrasundar Prabhu, who was a philosophy manager, he was Prabhupada's secretary, and he suggested that why don't, you know, I do summaries of the different philosophies, Greek and Western philosophers, and you can comment on that. The Prabhupada was very enthusiastic about that. They had a good number of sessions. It was all recorded, but then nothing happened. Chandrasundar also had problems, he left, and then nobody took it up. So in 1976, Prabhupada was complaining, where is this philosophy book? So when Hayagriva came back, then they said, now he can come, and you know, he'll go over, he'll revise the work that's already been done, and there were a few philosophers that had not been done, so he would also present them. So in the daytime, Prabhupada was meeting for 2 or 3 hours minimum every day with Hayagriva doing this philosophy book. Very heavy stuff. And then in the evenings, all through the night, he was working on his Bhagavatam as well. So he might have been working about 6, 8, 10 hours some days just writing. Yeah. So anyway, this was May the 10th. We were in Hawaii then. Ekadasi. So before going out for his morning walk, Prabhupada summoned me with the buzzer. Going into his room, I offered my obeisances and knelt before him, eager to execute his bidding. He asked if we had the Sanskrit edition of the Srimad Bhagavatam, 8th canto, with us. He said that he would finish the 7th canto in the evening. So this was very heartening to hear. If you read the last volume of the 7th canto, you'll see at the very end, Prabhupada puts a footnote there. And he says, you know, this has been completed on the Ekadasi day in Hawaii, Honolulu, like this, by the mercy of Panchatattva. Panchatattva were the presiding deities there. So this was that day. So last month in Vrindavan, we had discussed the literary, the travel itinerary with Rameshwara Swami. He had put in a strong plea to Prabhupada on behalf of the DVT to take advantage of the remoteness of Hawaii for this purpose, to increase his writing. Prabhupada has often said that if the devotees publish at the speed that he writes, he would be more and more encouraged. So when Rameshwara enthusiastically informed him that the BBT had almost caught up with him, he agreed to spend a month in Hawaii with the hope that it would increase his output. Now to hear that he was making good progress was at once fulfilling and inspiring. I was excited and I expressed my pleasure at this welcome news. Prabhupada remained modest and sober. With a slight smile and an unassuming tip of his head, he told me, "Oh, I can finish it very quickly, but I have to present it for your understanding. It requires deep thought, very carefully, for the common man." So, a lot of effort. It wasn't just a question of, you know, mechanically translating. He had to very deeply enter into the text and present the meaning in a way that any man could understand, even Malachas and Yadamas that we were. So, at 9:15 p.m. in the evening, he called for me. Expecting him to be ready to take rest and massage, I was surprised to find him at his desk with his spectacles on. His Bhagavatam was open and his dictaphone in his hand. He told me that he would not take his massage. Rather, he said he would finish translating the seventh canto. I was surprised but elated. It's the first time that I have been with him for over 5 months now that he has missed his evening rest. He worked all through the night, and after going for his early morning ablutions, I checked his dictaphone and saw that he had notched up 320 digits on the counter. So, you know, it's a tape recorder, and it had one of, you know, like a three-digit numbered counter, so that you can see how much of the tape that you've used up. So normally, he would do 50 digits or less. Now he was doing 320 digits, yeah? He was able to get 25 verses of the 8th canto done, as well as, you know, finish the 7th canto. He is mercifully fulfilling our hope that by spending extra time here in Hawaii, away from management problems and constant streams of visitors, that he would be able to concentrate on the essence of his preaching work. Everybody is growing very heartened to see how much extra writing he is doing since his arrival in Honolulu. And so, I put it here, that little end paragraph when he finished the 7th canto, this is what he wrote that evening. Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purport of the 7th canto, 15th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Instructions for Civilized Human Beings, completed on the night of Vaishakhi Shukla Ekadasi, the 10th of May, 1976, in the temple of the Panchatattva, New Nandadweep, Honolulu, by the mercy of Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda, Sri Advaita Gadadhar, Shivasadi Gaura Bhaktivinoda. Thus we may happily chant Hare Krishna,
Hare Krishna,
Krishna Krishna, Hare
Hare,
Hare
Ram,
Hare Ram,
Ram Ram,
Hare Hare.
So that was Prabhupada's little completion note there. A couple of days later, on the 15th of May, then, despite the disruptions of the day, Prabhupada and Hayagriva discussed the philosophies of Socrates and Plato for 2.5 hours this evening. And afterwards, Prabhupada went straight into his translation work, dictating throughout the night and notching up another 315 digits on the dictaphone. So that was the second time, again, no rest, no massage, straight from 2.5 hours of discussion on Socrates and Plato, and straight into the Bhagavatam for the whole night. Prabhupada had a very intense and amazing capacity to work, and the kind of concentration, I mean, as he said, I can do it very easily, quickly, if it's, you know, but it's not a question of that, it's a question of doing it very deeply. And that one example that occurred that illustrates the kind of concentration that Prabhupada was putting into it, that came up in November, on the 8th of November 1976, when we were back in Vrindavan. So just after taking rest at about 11 p.m., I heard the buzzer ring. Rolling out of my sleeping bag, I went into Prabhupada's darshan room, where he was already sitting at his desk, microphone in hand, peering over the pages of the Srimad Bhagavatam. After offering my obeisance, I sat before him, eager to know the purpose of his call. Prabhupada looked at me over the top of his glasses, and indicating something in mid-air, he said, "There's some noise, just stop it." I listened, but there was only silence to my ear. Seeing my puzzled expression, Prabhupada raised his eyebrows and his finger pointed upwards. "No, just listen." Again, I listened hard, trying to open up my ears and perceive whatever it was that was disturbing his divine grace. After a few seconds, I started to pick up on what seemed to be a very faint, distant hum. Prabhupada was observing me closely, and when he saw the dawn of recognition on my face, he confirmed my perception. "Ha! Now, go and find it and stop it." Now tuned in, I walked off to the entrance door, following the sound, which seemed to be coming from a source high up and distant. Going outside, I moved towards the temple, and the sound receded. Going the other way, towards the guest house, the faint vibration began to increase. I entered the building, and I started up the staircase, the humming beginning to increase in volume the higher that I climbed. Finally, I arrived at the top of the top floor of the four-story building, sure by this time that I had identified the cause. Going down the corridor, I banged on the door of one of the single rooms. After a minute, the door opened to reveal a sleepy, agitated Michelle Das, who was quite grumpy about being awakened at such a late hour. "Michelle Prabhu," I said humbly, "you've got your fan on, and it's disturbing Srila Prabhupada in his translation work." The fan was hanging from the ceiling, whirling around at full tilt, and I couldn't think why he would want to have it on in the cold of a winter night. But there was no discussion. Vishal immediately was profusely apologetic at the thought that he might be causing an inconvenience to Srila Prabhupada, and he quickly shut it off. After thanking him, I went back down into Srila Prabhupada's quarters, and when I entered, he was already deeply absorbed, sitting by the light of his desk lamp, studying the text, and flicking on and off the switch of his dictaphone microphone as he constructed his purports. He gave me but a brief glance of acknowledgement, and I took rest, impressed by the intense concentration that he applies to his work, and grateful for the opportunity to assist him with it. So that's very faint. You couldn't actually hardly hear it, but you know, it was disturbing. Now there was one occasion when Prabhupada actually wasn't able to do his work because of, you know, some outside distractions. That was when we got to Fiji. So we've been here in Melbourne, then we went to Auckland for about a day and a half. Then we arrived in Fiji, so we were there late April. And I had expected, you know, Fiji, tiny little place, middle of the ocean there, must be really quiet and peaceful. Prabhupada's going to get a lot done. Just the opposite. So on April the 29th, with few visitors, the day was quiet and Prabhupada has been able to relax. Fiji appears to be quite paradisical, but it is not perfect. Srila Prabhupada was disturbed by a constant night-long howling, emitting from what seemed to be like a multitude of dogs. It started off in one quarter of the town and flowed like a cacophonous wave around the entire district, and this prevented Prabhupada from translating. So the dogs were just barking and howling all night long. And he just, you know, it was too disturbing. He just couldn't work with that noise going on. Because if you've ever been to Vrindavan, it's quite nice there in the nighttime sometimes. Yeah. Because you hear dogs also there. But sometimes you hear the peacocks, and they also do that because they go up in the trees at nighttime. And different parts of Vrindavan, sometimes in the middle of the night, you can hear them. They start in one place, you know, and they start there. Calling, and then it flows. They wake up all the others, and then it flows all around Vrindavan. Yeah, it's really nice. All the peacocks calling. But anyway, dogs are not so nice. Actually, when we were in Vrindavan, I was giving Prabhupada his massage one evening, and he used to like to go up onto the roof of his quarters, and we had a cot out there, and you know, he liked to be in the open air. So I was giving him his massage, and a couple of dogs were down in the alleyway below, and they're, you know, doing what they do, howling and fighting. So Prabhupada said, he said, these dogs, he said, they are condemned. He said, they are the lowest species. He said, and there's nothing you can do. He said, they're howling because they're hungry. But if you feed them, then they become strong, then they'll do it even more. He said, there's nothing lower than a dog. So anyway, writing is hard work. Not an easy thing. Very hard work. So July 16, 1976, Prabhupada was in New York, and he was interviewed by nobody less than George Orwell, from the Associated Press. Not George Orwell, the author. This was George Orwell, the religions editor of the Associated Press. Because Associated Press means that, they're syndicated. They do an interview or something, and then that would go in many papers. Big newspapers all around the world. So he's a very nice man, Mr. Orwell, very interested in what Prabhupada was doing. He had previously attempted to meet him, I think when the devotees were still in Brooklyn, but somehow or another he couldn't get an interview. So then again he came in 1976. We had by that time got this 11-story building on West 55th Street, so big skyscraper. And Mr. Orwell came with his friend Bill, who was a photographer. So Mr. Orwell also asked Prabhupada what he thought about Judaism and Christianity. Prabhupada said that he didn't know because he had not studied them. But any religion, if it frees its adherents from the bodily conception of life, is first class. Mr. Orwell said that he didn't think that they did that. He thought that they considered the body important and they cherished the world. Prabhupada responded that such a conception was ignorance. He explained that he was attracting people from every religion and community because real knowledge is for everyone. Just as 2 plus 2 equals 4, the same is true for... just as 2 plus 2 equals 4 is the same for everyone, and gold is gold for everyone. Mr. Orwell asked, who has the gold? Just the Krishna consciousness movement, or are there other paths to spiritual enlightenment? Prabhupada replied that there were other paths, but they were not very elaborate. This prompted Mr. Orwell to ask if Krishna consciousness was elaborate. Prabhupada indicated his bookshelf. We are explaining this science in so many books. It is open to everyone. A writer himself, Mr. Orwell was very impressed with Prabhupada's output, especially when we told him that there was another 40 volumes yet to come. Are all of these translations that you have made, Your Grace? I don't blame you for sleeping only 4 hours a night. I tell you, just to produce half a dozen books in a lifetime is quite a job, you know. Prabhupada admitted, it is very difficult, but I have already produced 80 books. And all world scholars, professors, universities, they are receiving them very nicely. So that was from a man whose, profession was writing. And he was very impressed. You can do a half a dozen books in your lifetime, you're doing really well. And his Prabhupada's got 80 books. And he's running a worldwide movement at the same time. So, another comment that Prabhupada made. We were in Los Angeles, June the 9th. We've been there for about a week or so. And Prabhupada was having a meeting with Rameswara Swami. He was the BBT trustee for North America. And of course that was practically the most powerful position in ISKCON at that time. Book distribution was the entire focus of our preaching activities in ISKCON. And there was no congregational groups and preaching and that kind of thing in those days. It was just book distribution. And they were selling, hundreds, millions of books, actually, in North America. So Rameshwara was the man who was in charge of that. So wherever there is Srila Prabhupada and Rameshwara Swami, there must also be talk about books. Rajwara praised Srila Prabhupada for his prolific literary output. People are surprised how he could have written so many books. They cannot understand how he could write so much. They wonder whether you were a great Sanskrit scholar for many years, and they try to guess. They just can't imagine anybody writing so much. Prabhupada modestly acknowledged his compliment. We are exceeding all material authors, except the accident. One book, 17 volumes, Chaitanya Charitamrita. So that also, many of my godbrothers, they have attempted. So everybody is recognizing. Have any of your godbrothers translated anything? I asked Prabhupada. Prabhupada shook his head. They died halfway finished. He said somewhat wryly. Ravishwara said, they wonder whether you have where you have made the time to study so much about ancient Indian culture that you could write so much. They cannot understand that. There's a biography of your divine grace in the Bhagavatam that mentions different things, and they just can't understand how you could know so much. It is beyond any material conception. Prabhupada smilingly narrated an incident that he is fond of recalling. One young man in Tokyo or some such airport, very nice young man, he came, so I was sitting. Oh, Swamiji, can I talk with you? Yes. So I have seen your photograph. Where have you got so much vast knowledge? And I, no, it is not my knowledge, it is Vyasadeva's knowledge. So his first question was this. So, intelligent boy. Prabhupada liked that. This boy just was amazed. Where you got such vast knowledge from? And that was Prabhupada's reply. It's not my knowledge. I'm simply saying what the Vyasadeva says. Therefore, he said, we've exceeded all other authors except the Vyasadeva. Yeah. Of course, another aspect, another great literary personality in our life. Prabhupada did say, actually, it's in our line. He said, this is our family business. Yeah? Writing and printing books. It goes all the way back in our disciplic succession. All our big acharyas, they were all very prolific authors. So one of them, in fact, was on Thakur. So on August the 11th, 1976, Prabhupada had arrived in Tehran, in Iran. In those days, we had a small temple there with a few, maybe half a dozen devotees. Atreya Rishi was there with his wife and child. Navayogana was there with his wife and child. Jnanaganya was there, Brahmachari. Nandarani and Dayananda were there with their kids. And Paribrahma Bhattacharya Swami was there. And he was doing some amazing preaching. He was actually going to the Shah of Iran's palace two or three times a week to teach the Shah of Iran's daughter yoga. And he was the first Westerner ever to be allowed into the inner chambers of the Shah of Iran's palace. It's something like, you know, they said 2,000 years or something. So, you know, he had this connection with the royal family. Of course, later on, it didn't prove to be very useful because they got all tossed out. But at that time, it was like exceptional. It was amazing what they were doing. So, Prabhupada went there to visit, you know, just for 1 week, just to encourage the devotees. And he was giving very short classes. He was a little sick at that time. He had problems with his kidneys. And he would get this edema, this condition where the hands and feet swell up from too much uric acid in the body because the kidneys don't work properly. So he got that frequently. And it's a very painful condition. So in Iran he was having a little problem because the Tehran is quite high elevation. And the higher the altitude, the more difficulty it made. Anyway, so Prabhupada was giving this class, and he told us that although in the spiritual world we do not have to work to maintain our existence, here in the material world we do. And that was a comment for the devotees there, because that's how they were living in Tehran. Atreya Rishi was one of the top accountants for Arthur Young. Arthur Young was one of the biggest accountancy companies in the world. They were international. And Atreya Rishi, because he was from Iran, He had worked for them in New York, and then he became a devotee. And so he got permission from them to go to Iran and start a new branch of Arthur Young's in Tehran. So he was running that. And Dayananda was working for IBM. He was a computer programmer. In 76, of course, that was also quite exclusive. There weren't, now there's, computers are everywhere, but in those days there were no computers except the big, supercomputers. So he was a programmer for them. Navi Yavana also was doing some outside work. So they were all working in the day, they were householders. And they could just do a little preaching at night time or at the weekends. So Prabhupada was telling them, yes, you have to work here in the material world. This is not the spiritual world. So you have to work to maintain. And yet, we still have to become Krishna conscious. His words were pertinent because as soon as he finished his lecture, Atreya Rishi, Dayananda and the others would be going out to engage in seemingly mundane jobs. So Prabhupada cited another example to encourage them in what they are doing is actually spiritual. He said, because a devotee has nothing to do with material things. Even if he works for the maintenance of the body, that is not material. Just like Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who was a magistrate. So it is not for a magistrate to write so many books. Siddhanta Purna. So he was in a different, transcendental platform. Then it is possible. So the mind may be absorbed in Krishna's thought, Satatam Kirti Yantam Man, Tushyanti Cha Ramanti Cha. And that is possible by practice. So that was an example of Bhaktivinoda Thakur working in the day, but writing prolifically so many transcendental literatures, as Prabhupada was. Yeah, when he was doing his Bhakti Godhead and writing so many articles for his God Brothers magazines, he was also a householder, he was working, doing business. But still he found the time to write. So, again, another interview that Prabhupada had with Newsweek magazine. This was an interesting, it was quite funny actually. This was again in New York in July of 76. So we heard, oh, Newsweek is finally going to interview Srila Prabhupada, because the big magazines, Time and Newsweek, they didn't want to know about the Hare Krishnas. You know, we were a cult. So it wasn't very interesting. But somehow or another, we had hired a publicist, and this lady had managed to get Newsweek to agree to send a reporter to interview Srila Prabhupada. So we thought that's going to be really good. Then what they did was they sent a very junior girl. She might have been like 20 years old or something like this. And when Prabhupada heard that it was a woman reporter, junior reporter, he said, no. He said, I'm not going to speak to her. He said, when she comes, she'll just ask, how much money have you got? How many people are in your temples? How many temples have you got? That's it. So he said, I'm not going to meet with her. So she was already coming up the elevator. So they said, but Prabhupada, she's already here. So when she came in, Prabhupada was completely reticent. He wouldn't reply to anything that she asked him. And the first thing that she asked him was, how much money have you got? How many temples have you got? Like this. And as soon as she started asking about these kind of material aspects, Prabhupada just wouldn't reply. Why should I tell you? And he said that. She asked him a question, said, why should I tell you? She was amazed, I mean, she's a reporter from Newsweek. She's never had an interview with somebody that didn't want to be interviewed. So anyway, the whole thing threatened at one point to kind of shut down. She became completely flummoxed. She didn't know what to do. She looked, to Ravishwara, and she looked to the publicist, how do I do this? And Prabhupada sitting there completely, uncooperative. So anyway, then Rameshwara kind of gave a broad hint, and he pointed out all the books that were there, and he said, Prabhupada has written all of these books. You can ask him about the philosophy and, the writing of these books. As soon as he said that, Prabhupada just completely changed. Immediately he became very warm and open and friendly, and he immediately began speaking. So, that was a good lead, and that's what he really wanted to speak about. So the mention of his books gave Prabhupada the opportunity to guide the interview in the direction that he wanted it to go. So he began to open up a little. He told Wanda that if she really wanted to understand something about him, then she should read his books, because a man is known by what he speaks. Tavat shashobate mokayo vat yavat kinchin na bhashate. A fool is beautiful so long as he does not speak. When he speaks, then you can understand what he is. So my speaking is there in these books. And if you are intelligent, then you can understand. You haven't got to ask. Just like in a court, a big lawyer is known when he speaks. Otherwise, everybody's a good lawyer. And when he speaks in the court, then it is known whether he is a good lawyer or not. So you have to hear and you have to read, and then you will understand. The real understanding is there. So that was it. Was happy with that. So I thought, go and read my book. And again, another interview that Prabhupada had, a more successful one. This was in London a couple of weeks later. And Prabhupada received Mike Robinson from the London Broadcasting Company. He was a young man, new actually, but a very intelligent young man, very keen for the interview, asked really good questions, and then really sharp. He really picked up on the philosophy as it was going along. And actually, at the end of that interview, Prabhupada was so happy with it, he said 90% of our philosophy is in this one interview. And he told the devotees that we published this in the Back to Godhead, which they did. And Mike Robinson was so happy with the interview, he later on, he came back to the Back to Godhead Manor, and then he did, you know, like a whole program just on the devotees, because it was so interesting. I think he's still with the London Broadcasting Company, or at least he was a few years ago, and he had become like one of their big executives. So anyway, at this point he was just like a junior reporter. So anyway, they had a very successful interview, and then apparently satisfied, Mike asked his remaining question. Perhaps finally then, I could ask you, do you ever have any doubts? That's his problem. Prabhupada's eyes widened. If I have doubts, how am I preaching? Then that means I'm a cheater. How am I writing so many books? Do you think a man with doubts can produce, in a doubtful condition, he can produce so many books? Do you think like that? Mike became a little sheepish, especially hearing us chuckling in the background. Well, I don't know, I just... Well, you should know, Prabhupada. His strength of conviction making us all laugh. So you never doubt any of this, anything at all. Prabhupada smiled at him. We are sure. So that was... Okay, so that was Prabhupada's writing. As he mentioned earlier, you know, his Guru Maharaj was not very happy with his disciples because they were not writing and they were not producing books. So Prabhupada noted that, and he decided that if I'm ever going to do any service for my spiritual master, it will be these books. That was his particular interest. So one criticism that we heard from Prabhupada about his godbrothers was in this reference. We were in Calcutta, this was January the 14th, 1976. During Prabhupada's massage, which he took on sitting on a mat in a little patch of sunlight on the bathroom floor, Tamal Krishna Goswami came in to report on a visit that he and Jayapataka Maharaj had just made to the Sri Chaitanya mat. Tamal Krishna Maharaj had just come on that month as the visiting GBC secretary for Prabhupada. And Jayapataka Maharaj was in charge of Mayapur in Calcutta at that time. So they had talked with Madhava Maharaj, Prabhupada's godbrother, showing him Prabhupada's translation of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. They asked if Prabhupada's books could be displayed there during a current 5-day festival that the Chaitanya Mat is holding. But Madhava Maharaj only gave them excuses why it was not possible. That answers your question, right, from yesterday. Why didn't Prabhupada go to his godbrothers to get his translations from English into Indian languages? This is why. Because they weren't cooperative. They weren't interested in Prabhupada's works. They didn't, you know, appreciate them. And Prabhupada knew that. So, as they were leaving the mat, Tamal Krishna and Jayapataka stopped to talk with the secretary. So he appeared interested and friendly, and he inquired about the books. The secretary said that he felt that they should follow our example in preaching, but they were tied up too much in routine temple maintenance work. Be warned.
Yeah.
You have a big institution, it's very easy to get wrapped up in routine temple maintenance and think that that is, you know, why you're here, but it's not. The temples are only for preaching, and the whole of ISKCON is only meant for preaching. That's all. Not routine temple maintenance work. That has to go on. I'm not saying not, but the point is that you have to be engaged in preaching work. So this man was acknowledging, you're all out preaching, you have so many books like that, but here we are, we're just stuck looking after the mud. So looking over their advertising brochure, Prabhupada noted that the invited speakers for their festival included no sannyasis or spiritual personalities. They were simply government ministers and that kind of class of men. Whereas for us, Prabhupada's books are the main feature of our preaching work. Prabhupada noted that after 40 years, the Gaudiya Math is still selling only Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's books. He was critical that they have not been able to produce any literature of their own. So not that he's obviously against them selling Bhaktisiddhanta's books, but that's all they had after 40 years. None of them were able to actually produce their own books. That means, you know, what realizations do they have? He said that many of his godbrothers were envious of his success, and he specifically named three of them. Prabhupada's comments show that he has learned not to expect anything from them. He told us that we should avoid dealing with them. He said that rather than help, they will simply attempt to spoil our work. So that was, you know, there was that tension there between Prabhupada and his godbrothers. So again, that was it was an interesting comment. So after 40 years, not one book. That was a criticism. Yeah. Whereas he was, you know, producing like anything. So August the 21st, 1976, we were in Hyderabad, temple opening there. And Jagannatha Maharaj and Garga Muni had come from the east and attended Prabhupada's Vyasa Puja. They gave a very upbeat report about all of the activities that were going on in Mayapur at that time. So on the 21st, they had a final darshan of Srila Prabhupada in the evening before leaving back for Calcutta. Along with Garga Muni Maharaj, Jagannatha heard from Srila Prabhupada the proactive stance that he is taking against all the false propaganda that was being generated by the communists. When Prabhupada came back to India in the summer of 76, the communists were becoming more and more powerful, and so they had started agitating in the Indian parliament that who are these Americans that are in ISKCON? All CIA. Yeah? They have so much money. How they get so much money? This man was an old penniless sadhu. Now he comes back with the Americans. He's got so much money, unlimited money. He must be under the pay of the CIA. They're all spies like this. So this propaganda was going on very strongly, and a lot of people believed it also. It came up in Parliament, you know, and so Prabhupada was, you know, having to actively preach against that, and he was contacting government ministers. So he was telling Jagannatha Maharaj that he had written a letter to Mr. Channa Reddy, one of the state governors. So Channa Reddy, he was the chief minister who had come as the chief guest when we opened our Vrindavan temple in 1975. So he was very friendly with Srila Prabhupada. So Prabhupada immediately wrote to that to Channa Reddy to speak up on his behalf in the parliament. So I'm writing one letter to the governor that I work hard, I print my books, and they are selling. And if I bring that money to construct a temple, then why are people envious? What is the wrong there? Rather, I should be encouraged that I am bringing so much money into India, foreign exchange, and by my very, very hard labor. So why are they envious? Because that was where all the funds were coming from. It was all from book distribution. Garga Muni Maharaj said that he felt it was difficult for them to believe that a sadhu could possess so much money simply from selling books. That may be beyond their dream, Prabhupada said, but I am not a so-called sadhu. I am trying to execute the orders of my Guru Maharaj, predecessor. I am not a so-called sadhu, taking this saffron rug and begging for fulfilling the belly. They have to accept you as an international leader, Gagamuni said. I must be international leader, Prabhupada agreed, as a matter of fact, adding that such huge sales of a single person's books, especially philosophical and religious works, was unique in history. He laughed and said that the public generally considered such literature to be untouchable. Thus, he said, his feat was even more remarkable. Observing that the Mayavadi, Vivekananda, had produced only one small booklet, Thus Spake. Yeah, they have this series, Thus Spake Vivekananda, Thus Spake this one, this little tiny book like this. So Prabhupada was observing, that's his literature. And then two of his own leading Godbrothers, Bon and Tirtha Maharajis, have not been able to produce any substantial literature. Prabhupada said that they were chalas, bluffers who make a show but have no real assets. What is that? Bon Maharajis, this Institute for Indian Culture and Philosophy, but where is your book? That was his challenge. Of course, there was a bit of tension there between him and Bon Maharaj. Bon Maharaj was one of the first devotees. He was in a group of three that was sent by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati to the West, to London, to attempt to begin preaching Krishna consciousness in the 1930s. So they were there for some years. They had they were taking, I think, something like 700 rupees a month from India. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was sending to them to support them whilst they were in England. You can imagine. And after several years, nothing. One old lady with a house some distant place in London, and that was declared to be the Gaudiya Mat. She was initiated, that lady, and that was it. They were called back, no success, nothing. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta actually was not very happy with their efforts, particularly wasn't very happy with Bon Maharaj. So then later on, of course, Prabhupada goes to the West, you know, 30 years later. And as soon as he gets there, boom, you know, Krishna consciousness spreads all over the world. So by 1975, you know, when Prabhupada started up this, what we call the library party. So the library party was selling full sets, or standing orders for full sets of Prabhupada's books to all the libraries and all the universities in America and Europe, and they came to India and all over the world, East Germany. It was going everywhere. So Bon Maharaj, he had maintained some contacts with scholars, and he used to present himself not so much as a Vaishnava, but as a scholar, you know, of Indian or Oriental philosophy and religion. And he had some contacts there in America. So in 1975, some news came that Bon Maharaj was advising professors in America not to buy Prabhupada's books. Yeah. Then would ask, you know, what do you think about this? Should we get a set? And then he would say no. And he would say so many things, you know, to dissuade them. So then when Prabhupada heard that, he said, you know, this man is envious. That's all. He can't appreciate, you know, how Krishna consciousness is being spread everywhere. Amazing. Rather not. He has some personal thing there. So Prabhupada said, we shall have nothing to do with it anymore. Anyway, so then this was his challenge, because Bon Maharaj himself, he had this Institute for Indian Culture and Philosophy in Vrindavan, big, huge piece of land, right across the road from our Krishna Balaram Mandir. Nothing on it, actually, some few buildings, but most of it was vacant. Did he offer it to Prabhupada to, you know, help him set up the temple then? No. And he couldn't do anything with it either. And of course, nowadays it's become the Bon Maharaj Institute for Technology and something or other. So whatever he tried to do, it all finished. Now the government took it over. They left his name on it, the Bon Maharaj Institute, for what? Management and Technology. Yeah. In Vrindavan. So what, you know, what effect was it from all of his work? And also, as Prabhupada said, where is your book? He had this big so-called institute. He attempted to translate the Nectar of Devotion. He got halfway through and couldn't do it, couldn't finish it. But Prabhupada knew very well, you know, what his godbrothers were capable of. which wasn't very much. You know, Prabhupada measured success how many books you can write and distribute. Yeah, that was his measure of success. So anyway, Prabhupada was obviously very much involved in so many different managerial issues. The bigger the movement got, the more demanding it was. By the time I got to be on Prabhupada's party and was traveling with him in 1976, there was over 100 temples and about 5,000 disciples. And of course in the West, Prabhupada had trained his men and they were running things pretty well, you know, efficiently, with a minimum of input from Srila Prabhupada. But in India we had very big projects going on. Vrindavan had just been opened, but that was only the beginning of the headaches rather than the end of them, because every time we went there, you know, there were so many things that were not being done correctly, and Srila Prabhupada would have to spend all his time meeting with the managers, going over every single item, you know, even down to, you know, how much money they were spending on each deity offering. I mean, I remember one time he sat with Bhagavati, one of the local men, and they worked out how much it cost for each pudding that was put on the plate of the deities, you know, each amount of subji, like everything, right down to the last rupee, because they were overspending and he wanted to cut back that, you know, that fat. How much they were spending on the flowers every day. So they were getting all these garlands. And Prabhupada would go out and greet the deities, and then he would see all these ragged flowers, you know, on the deities. And then he would chastise Akshayananda Swami, he was the temple president, that they're selling you simply rubbish, you know, all the old flowers. And they would bring a basket of flowers, like on a regular order. And what they would do, it was by weight. So they'd put some bricks or stones or something in the bottom of the basket to make it heavier. And all the flowers were all the old leftover ones. So only Prabhupada was picking up on all of this stuff. And his attention to detail and his concern for how much money that we were spending, you know, was remarkable. There was one afternoon, we were up on the roof, Prabhupada had had his rest, and then he was sitting in a rocking chair, just up on the roof, just kind of enjoying the afternoon atmosphere, and he heard a noise down at the down below. There was the side gate of the Krishna Balaram Mandir. It led out into the alleyway. So there was, he heard some noise there. So he told me, he said, "What's, go and see what's going on." I looked down. There was a man with a bicycle, and the gate was locked. So he was trying to get the chowkidar to come and unlock it. He had a box on the back of his bicycle, and there were all vegetable scraps, you know, small box, and vegetable scraps on the back of the bicycle. So I told Prabhupada, and he immediately stood up, he went over, he looked down, he shouted at the man with the bicycle, "So you stay right there, you don't move." And then he shouted at the chowkidar, then he shouted for the temple managers. Then when they came up, then he chastised them like anything. Prabhupada Krishna, he was there, he was the chief expert. And he you know, he really chastised them. This man, he was the brother of somebody that worked in the kitchen, right? He didn't even work for us. But he was coming every day and they were giving him all the vegetable scraps to take away for free. And he was feeding his cows with it. Prabhupada really was angry. He said, "Why is it that I'm the only one that sees him for these things?" He said, "He's taking so much." He said, "That could be fed to our cows." He said, "Why is it going outside like this?" He was really angry. So, that, you know, and he said, "Why is it that I'm the only one that sees these things?" He said, "Whenever I come here, I simply get a headache like this." So anyway, that was, you know, Prabhupada's involvement in management. Huge things, operations going on all over the place. Bombay was being constructed at that time, $70,000 a month had to be sent from the BBT in America to pay for the construction, every month, guaranteed. Then there was Mayapur, where Prabhupada was planning to build, you know, a big city there. It was already being advertised, this temple of the Vedic Planetarium. And anyway, so, you know, Prabhupada was very concerned about everything. And at the same time, he wanted to write. So he had this very amazing schedule, so he could do everything at once. But now and again it would come out, and he would always repeatedly say, why don't you learn to manage so that I can retire and do my real work, which is writing my books. So on February the 28th, 1976, Prabhupada was in Mayapur. So when he spoke with Kiziraj Prabhu the other day, Prabhupada had approved certain plans for preaching in Poland. So at that time, Kiziraj was Polish stock. He was in America, and he had started some correspondence with some people in Poland. Again, you know, the whole thing there was the Iron Curtain. Nobody could penetrate these communist countries except at great risk. But Kiziraj was doing some active preaching there in Eastern Europe, in Poland. So Prabhupada had approved some plans that he had for doing something there. But then on hearing that Hansa had already formulated another strategy for the same preaching, he was in Europe, then he cancelled his own suggestions. He told Kiziraj simply to follow the GBC's instructions. So this policy of referring things for GBC approval, both individually and collectively, is something that Prabhupada is doing more and more. His divine grace often says that he wants to be relieved from all management as soon as possible, not when he leaves the planet, but long before, so that he can retire and write his books. And again, this came up. We were in Hawaii in May. He had gone there because ostensibly there wasn't going to be any managerial concerns to deal with, no visitors, he could do so much more writing, which he was doing. But still, some problems were coming up. There was a fight going on between the temple president and the local GBC, which ended up with the temple president coming and complaining to Prabhupada personally that he wasn't being dealt with properly by the GBC. So, because the GBC had his own opinions about the temple president also. So Prabhupada was the one that he came to. So as a result of that meeting, Prabhupada dictated a letter to all the GBCs. He had it sent down. So in the evening, this was on the 18th, he spoke for a long time about how it would be very difficult to finish the Srimad Bhagavatam if so many managerial problems continued to arise. He dictated a general letter to all the GBC members, asking them to become more responsible and relieve him of the managerial burdens. He compared his ISKCON movement to the British Empire, saying that it was actually more extensive because we have not yet finished our expansion. The British Empire had gone so big and then stopped. The problem is we have only just started to begin, and we're already in more countries than the British were. So he wants us to continue to grow, but he also wants to be given the opportunity to complete his translation work. I must now remind you that I have to complete the translation of the Srimad Bhagavatam. That is the greatest contribution. Our books have given us a respectable position. People have no faith in this church or temple worship. Those days are gone. Of course, we have to keep our spirits high. Simply intellectualism will not do. There must be practical purification. So it's saying people don't have faith in, you know, in temples and churches and like this organized, formalized religion. But at the same time, we have our temples because that keeps us pure, looking after the deities, keeping up the standards like that. But and it can't be just intellectual book knowledge. There has to be practical application. So we have them. But still, the real point is, the Bhagavatam is the key. So, I request you to relieve me of management responsibilities more and more so that I can complete the Srimad Bhagavatam translation. If I am always having to manage, then I cannot do my work on the books. It is documents. I have to choose each word very soberly. And if I have to think of management, then I cannot do this. I cannot be like these rascals who present something mental concoction to cheat the public. So this task will not be finished without the cooperation of my appointed assistants, the GBC, temple presidents, and sannyasis. I have chosen my best man to be GBC, and I do not want that the GBC should be disrespectful to the temple presidents. You can naturally consult me, but if the basic principle is weak, then how will things go on? So please assist me in the management so that I can be free to finish the Srimad Bhagavatam, which will be our lasting contribution to the world. So that was Prabhupada's concern. Somehow or another, he had that ambition that it would get to a point one day where he could walk away from the management and just work on his books. But of course, it never happened. Yeah. He was translating up until the very last, and he was also dealing with management practically up until the last. Anyway, the following month, June 17, Prabhupada was in Toronto. Again, this business of writing and versus management came up. Prabhupada discussed the management in Detroit. He'd just come from the Detroit temple. And Prabhupada observed that things were not going very well there. There was a new temple president, but he was not very popular with the devotees there. And the previous temple president, who had been very popular with the devotees, was spiritually weak. So he had been asked to stand down, and this new man had come in. And although he was very competent, but he wasn't very good at dealing with devotees. So then, you know, Prabhupada saw that. He didn't say anything while we were in Detroit, but when we came to Toronto, then he called in the GBC, Jagadish, and he began to discuss with him. So he wanted to know why the previous temple president, Govardhana Das, had been removed. He was well liked by the devotees, and Prabhupada agreed with Jagadish's description of him as a very gentle soul. Prabhupada said that he had rendered tangible devotional service. It was due to him that Ambarish and Lakesh Ravanti Prabhu had been engaged in obtaining the Fisher estate in Detroit. They both gave $150,000 each to found a Detroit temple. Moreover, Prabhupada had received complaints in Detroit about Madhavananda's management, who he said was intelligent and a good preacher, but in other temples had also been in the center of controversy over his lavish spending habits. Although Prabhupada had initiated the conversation, when Jagadish Prabhu asked him what he should do about it, Prabhupada declined to direct him. So he brought it up as a topic, but he didn't give any solution. And then Jagadish asked, well, what should we do? And Prabhupada said, no. He said, I do not wish to interfere. You manage now. I want to see that you are managing without my interference. Now, practically, I want to concentrate more on writing books, or absolutely, I want to do that. But sometimes this management gives me too much anxiety. I do not wish to see that somehow or another that we have built up such a nice institution, and on account of lack of management, it may be hampered. That is my only anxiety. Okay, so that's an overview that tells us a bit about Prabhupada's efforts, you know, to write his Bhagavatam, especially the Bhagavatam that was going on. And you can see what tremendous energy and, you know, concentration and time had to go in to produce these things. You know, we walk into ISKCON temples nowadays, it all seems like it's always been there and it seems to run fairly effortlessly. But it wasn't like that. You know, when you have to set things up from scratch, you know, there's, as Prabhupada said, I have to give gallons of my blood, yeah, to get these books out, to build these temples. He said, if you waste that, he said, you're, you know, draining my blood. Yeah, you're wasting my blood, like this. So anyway, it's almost 9 o'clock. I think we'll finish at this point. Tomorrow morning will be the last session. And we'll go on with this. We'll talk about other writing projects that Prabhupada had, apart from the Bhagavatam. There were many other things that, you know, Prabhupada had written, different styles, poetry that Prabhupada had written a little bit, and other plans that he had for writing. And we may also get to a section where, you know, there's some instructions by Prabhupada about his disciples also becoming writers, following his example. So, does anybody have any questions or comments at this point? No questions. Nobody has any questions? Yes.
I was just thinking, where would he be at this stage now? Do you think he might have come back, or he's back home?
Do I think whether Prabhupada has come back or whether he's gone back home?
Yeah.
What happened to Prabhupada? We don't know. That's up to Krishna. But in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it says that a pure devotee lives simultaneously in the spiritual world and the material world. So my answer would be both.
Yeah.
He went back to Godhead and he's in the material world preaching. Because for a pure devotee, the two things are the same. The material world is the spiritual world because it's Krishna's energy. Of course, in the material world, we define that as being a place that is devoid of any sense of Krishna. That's what it means to be material. Yeah. And spiritual means when you see everything in connection with Krishna. So whether you're so-called here or there, the pure devotee is always with Krishna. But in the difference is that in the spiritual world, there's no preaching going on. Because everybody's already pure devotee. Yeah, there's nobody to preach to. It's just like when Krishna wants to fight. Yeah, there's nobody to fight with in the spiritual world. So he comes to the material world. And some devotee, you know, they come also. They appear as a Hiranyakashipu or a Ravana or like that. And then they give a good fight to Krishna. He enjoys that. Some sport. He comes into the material world to do that. So similarly, the preaching activities, because that is the main feature of Lord Chaitanya's movement, yeah, going out and spreading Krishna consciousness all around the world, Pratika Chaya Chaya Chaitanya Nagaradi Gram, everywhere it has to go. And so the pure devotees, they come to the material world just to engage in this pastime of preaching, of, you know, rescuing and enlightening the conditioned souls, those who are in ignorance of Krishna. But, you know, they're always there with Krishna as well. Both ways. Actually, here in Melbourne, there was a couple of boys that came to see Prabhupada one time, and they asked Srila Prabhupada, you know, if he was always seeing Krishna, if he was always aware of Krishna. And then Prabhupada, he looked at them and he said, first of all, he said, will you believe what I tell you? Then when they said yes, whatever you say, will I accept? He said, then he said yes. He said, I am seeing Krishna everywhere at every moment. Yeah. So, for Prabhupada, personalities like Srila Prabhupada, it doesn't make any difference whether they go back to Godhead or they take another birth because they're doing the same thing.
They have fully Krishna consciousness.
Yes. And if they take birth, it's not because of their previous karma. Just like it was when we were our bodies. You know, the chances are we'll have to take another birth somewhere else and receive the results of all the things that we've done in this lifetime and in past lifetimes. We are forced. But personalities like Srila Prabhupada, they're not forced. They're not forced. They come on a mission.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like you said, you no human can all those volumes of books. No human beings can write all those volumes of Bhagavad Gita and that. It's because for the missions, for the grace of Krishna.
Yes, His Divine Grace, that title, His Divine Grace. It means the grace, only by Krishna's grace can you get out of this material world. So you get Krishna's grace by getting contact with Krishna's representatives. That's so, the system. So therefore we call the spiritual master His Divine Grace, because he carries the grace of God. And interestingly, Prabhupada told us one time, we were in New York, and I think it was Rameshwara, he asked Srila Prabhupada that just like when Krishna appears somewhere in the material world to do his pastimes, there are so many associates that go with him to assist him in his mission. So he said, does the spiritual master, does he also have his assistants who go with him, you know, wherever he goes, in order to help with his preaching? And Prabhupada said, yes. He said he has his associates, and they also take birth, and they help him with this movement, with this mission preaching. and the reader.
Because it's a dichotomy, I suppose, which is a question of balance, the management versus the sadhana, or the spiritual side of things. Did Prabhupada at any time take a retreat or a break and just go on right? Or did he always keep that program of preaching and writing?
Did Prabhupada at any time take a break and have a spiritual retreat?
No, I mean, a
writing retreat.
A writing retreat.
The closest I think that he got to that, he did do that on one or two occasions. In the late 1960s, or early 70s actually, when they got the Los Angeles temple, Watsika Avenue, that was the first big temple purchase that they made. And Prabhupada declared that to be the world headquarters. He wanted, you know, Los Angeles to demonstrate all the activities of Krishna consciousness. And then other devotees from other temples were told to go to Los Angeles and learn, you know, all the standards that were there. So whilst that was going on, Prabhupada himself was not staying at the temple. He was staying somewhere else. And he was not visiting the temple that much. But he was actually working on teachings of Lord Chaitanya, Nectar of Devotion, and the Krishna book. So he was spending most of his time writing. And for some months, he wasn't, you know, actively going to the temple that much. He was coming and going, but mainly he was just writing. He wasn't traveling very much. But I was just explaining that the expansion of ISKCON really took off, you know, from 68 onwards. And the more it expanded, then the more there were demands on Prabhupada, you know, to visit different places. Just like he used to come to Australia once a year for 1 week a year. So it's a long way to come, you know. And many other places. But the only other example I can think of Prabhupada kind of taking some time out for writing was when he went to Hawaii. We had 1 month there. And it was specifically so that he could write more. And he did write more. He wrote a lot more. Still, there was some management coming up now and again. But
in Prabhupada's example, because in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's the comments by Lord Chaitanya in relationship to Haridasa Thakur, and he says, you know, you're the perfect devotee because you set a strict example of sadhana. And you preach. Now, there are those who preach but don't act properly, and those who act perfectly but don't preach. Mm-hmm. So, in that regard, we can see Prabhupada, you know, he did both. Now, what lesson can we draw from that, especially in our later years? Are we going to retire as
What do we draw from Prabhupada's example of preaching and practicing, yes, his behavior and his preaching activity. And there was actually a letter that was sent to Srila Prabhupada from the devotees in Los Angeles, I think, for his Vyasa Puja in 1976. In that letter, they expressed their indebtedness to Srila Prabhupada. You know, that you've given us so much, there's no way that we can repay that debt. And so in Prabhupada's reply, he said, yes, that's a fact. You can't repay the debt. But he said, you can try. And he said that you should do as I am, if you at all want to repay that debt, he said, then do as I am doing. Do as I am doing. That means work hard. Preach, you know, as much as possible. Practice as nicely as possible. Because he did sometimes say, I think he told one devotee, you know, work now, samadhi later. Yeah, that was a famous expression that used to fly around the movement. Work now, samadhi later. And I've looked in folio, I can't find that anywhere. But it was well known, it's one of those well known sayings. And Prabhupada did kind of indicate that, you know, as young young men and women, we should work very hard whilst we can. And then later on, when we get old, then we can actually retire after having had a lifetime of preaching. But for Srila Prabhupada, there was no question of retirement. He began when he was retired. So he didn't have the opportunity. He was building everything from scratch. He had to be involved in everything. You know? I mean, every single item, every aspect, you know, how to practice Krishna consciousness, how to eat, how to sleep, you know, how to speak, how to behave, you know, where to live, how to live together, you know, how to worship the deities, everything. It was all coming from just him personally. So there's no question for Prabhupada to be able to kind of get out of that. And he knew that. You know, he was on a very rapid, you know, he put us on a very rapid learning curve, steep learning curve, as they say. We had to learn everything in a few short years because he knew he's old and, you know, he could go at any time. And he would tell us that very frequently. If you see, then Prabhupada really, he retired practically after March of 1977. And that was because he was forced to, because his body was finished. So from that period onwards, that last 6 or 8 months, really Prabhupada was not, he dropped out of his preaching leela. And he retired, you know, near Janabajan. He had a few senior men with him, Tamal Krishna Maharaj, and Upendra came back as his servant. And, you know, it was just basically the last few months Prabhupada was just exhibiting some ecstasies. He was appreciating, you know, what his disciples were doing. He was still doing some translation work on the Bhagavatam, that was still going on. But to all intents and purposes, his active involvement in ISKCON was over at that point. So he just, you know, but he does say in the Srimad Bhagavatam that there's a certain point at which the spiritual master retires from active preaching, and he turns everything over to his trusted disciples. And he retires with a few senior disciples, and you know, he just absorbs himself in his bhajan. That's nirjana bhajan. So that may be, that will come, hopefully, for a lot of us. But there's no harm if you drop dead whilst preaching. That's a good thing. So.
Prabhupada is unique, and to us it's slightly different because we have to balance just our purification. We have to balance our purification with our service.
Yeah.
Because Prabhupada's writing wasn't for his, well, I guess you know, as an example, it was for his personal purification. As in a sense that, you know, Sandhu set the example for us.
Mm.
But Prabhupada didn't have to do it for purification. As you said already, whereas we probably have to take our own purification into consideration.
Yes, I mean, we're practicing Sadhana Bhakti. Prabhupada was on the level, you know, Raghunuga Bhakti, in beyond, you know. But we're Sadhana Bhaktis, you know, we have to practice. If we don't strictly practice, then the chances are we will fall into Maya. Yeah, so we have our ups and downs. For Prabhupada, there's no question. If Prabhupada didn't chant 16 rounds, you know, it didn't make any difference to his consciousness because he was already fully Krishna conscious. If we don't chant our 16 rounds, we'll be in trouble. That, you know, there is a difference. But, you know, we have the confidence that if we follow Prabhupada's example and we do what he's told us to do, we will get to that platform of, you know, fully purified Sudha Bhakti, you know, real Krishna consciousness. But it will take some time, that's all. In the meantime, Prabhupada said it doesn't matter, even if you're not a pure devotee, you have to go out and preach. So the means for preaching, it was all, I mean, the means for purification was preaching. And at the same time, to be able to preach, you have to be purified. So the two are, you know, Prabhupada made it in such a way the two go simultaneously together.
Sometimes the devotees feel that the burden of maintaining the temple especially we have a medium-sized canopy. It's too great, and it restricts the preaching. The burden of maintaining the temple stops us from getting out on book distribution, stops us from doing other activities that are directly related to preaching. So how do we resolve that?
The question is, sometimes it's observed that the burden of maintaining a temple becomes so great that it restricts the ability to go out and preach. Because the temples are not meant to be maintained just for living in. Yeah, the temples are also preaching. That's what they're there for. It's not like in India, you go to so many temples. The only reason that they dress the deities is so that they can, you know, get some money in their mundi, so that they can buy some rice and dal and eat and sleep. Prabhupada condemned that. You know, there's that Bengali saying about how they take the Shalagram Shila and they use it for cracking nuts. Right? It means the Shalagram Shila, that's Krishna himself, he has to be worshipped. But if you're in that consciousness, mundane consciousness, you think, oh, this is just some stone. Yeah? Crack nuts with it. That means that you're exhibiting the deities simply for the purpose of getting some money so that you can eat and sleep. Not as a matter of devotion. So in that circumstance, the maintenance of the temple does become a burden because there's no real feeling. When we were in Vrindavan in 76, I think September, October time, Prabhupada commented on that. Because he had, you know, several times he'd come, he saw, when he greeted the deities, the garlands weren't on. Or the deities weren't properly dressed. The devotees were struggling a bit to get it, you know, done on time. And Prabhupada used to get very annoyed about it. So when it happened about, you know, two or three times, then again one morning they opened up the curtains and there's Krishna and Balaram with no garlands on. Yes. And then Prabhupada turned around, he was really angry. Yes. And Akshayananda was there, he was the temple president. Prabhupada turned around, he looked at him, he scowled at him, he said, "This is another farce." He was really angry. And then he went off and then he gave this class. And during the class, it was about bhava, yeah, spiritual feelings. So he said, if there's no bhava, he said, then this temple, he said, then it will simply become a big go down. That's all. He said, then they'll think, oh, this old man, he's left us with this burden. Yeah? Having to maintain these deities, having to maintain this temple, this old man, he's just left us with this burden. So he said, no bhava, there has to be some bhava, there has to be some genuine love for Krishna. And then it's not a burden, or if it is a burden, it's a burden of love. Yeah? But Prabhupada, you know, he taught this principle of using the temples as a place of education, as a place for conveying the science of Krishna consciousness. It's not a place just for simply worshipping the deity. It's a place for teaching people the science of Krishna consciousness. That's preaching. So therefore, you know, maintaining a temple is an integral part of preaching in ISKCON. So we don't regard that as being a detraction from preaching. If you can attract so many people to a temple, see the beautiful deities, and move them, you know, by your bhava, by your feeling, and inspire them to buy the books, then you don't have to go out on the street to sell the books. They're coming to you. So that we don't see the difference between, you know, temple worship and preaching. They're the same activity. But it's not so in many other places. And I saw, practically, when we went to Jagannath Puri in 1977, in January, we visited a couple of Prabhupada's godbrothers' temples. And we saw, you know, when we went there, nobody was there. It was in the evening time. And the deities had no garments. And even, you know, just the lighting. They had one tiny little 25 watt bulb. above the deities, you could barely see them, and that was it. When we came in, we had a big kirtan, and then, you know, the few devotees that were living in the temple, they came out and they switched the lights on so that we could see, you know, see the deities better. We had a nice kirtan, and then we went from that temple to another one. And the other temple was almost the same situation. So it kind of struck me as a little odd. And when we got back to Bhubaneswar, I asked Srila Prabhupada, I said, how is it, you know, that, you know, we have, they have the same facility as us, but, you know, their temples are so run down, nobody goes to them, they're almost derelicts. And so Prabhupada said, what facility? Well, he said, what is that facility? I said, well, at least they have the same philosophy, you know. And then, you know, these are the men, the same men that originally went out and they collected the money that built those temples, but now they can barely maintain them. You know, they're all run down. And so it struck me as a little odd. You know, surely they were inspired to go out and preach and, you know, attract all that support, then they should be at least be able to maintain it. So Prabhupada said they're not preachers. He said they're all third class men. He said all they know how to do is to beg some money and eat and sleep, that's all. He said, but they're not preaching. So that's the difference. Yeah. If we really want to, you know, maintain a temple properly, it means on the basis of preaching. It means on the basis of being inspired, you know, by understanding here is Krishna personally with us. And our business in life is to worship him and serve him and, you know, offer our lives to him. Not that we're using the deities, you know, to attract some money so we can eat and sleep. But rather, you know, the deities, we are being used by the deities to go out and spread Krishna consciousness. You know, it's the other way around. Instead of, you know, making the deities the servant, our servants, you know, making them a means of earning a livelihood, which Prabhupada criticized many temples in Vrindavan and other places for. Rather, we are the servants of the deities. They're not idols. It's Krishna himself, and we're here, you know, to worship him, serve him, attract others to come and serve him like that. So, if you're maintaining the temple, yeah, it's hard work. Keep everything going, you know, keep up the deity schedules, keep all the devotees fed, and, you know, keep all the preaching going. But all of it's the same activity. You asked one question before. Is there any other question from anybody else? Yes?
The Vedas actually being transcribed into all the books, or I think it's really...
I didn't get your question.
Yes. All the Vedas being transformed into the 80 books or still not?
Is all the Vedas been transformed into the 80 books that Prabhupada produced? No, Prabhupada picked out the essential literatures for the Gaudiya Vaishnavas. That's what we are. We come in that light, the Gaudiya Vaishnavas. There are many other works. There's, you know, 18 Puranas. There's so many corollary literatures. There's the Rig Veda, Samaveda, Yajurveda, like that. There's the four original Vedas. But Prabhupada picked the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam, and then, you know, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu and a few other books, because they are the essential books for achieving Krishna prayer. You can read many other books in the Vedas, Vedanta Sutra, but there it is not directly indicated worship of Krishna. Indirectly it's there. The Upanishads are there. 108 Upanishads. Very few of them give you direct information about the personality of Godhead. Now, Prabhupada wanted to give us the essence and bring us immediately to the platform of bhakti. So the bhakti literatures, they're the important ones for us. That's the Srimad Bhagavatam. And then of course Chaitanya Charitamrita, because as Prabhupada said, Lord Chaitanya is the living Bhagavatam. And Bhagavad Gita of course is the ABCs of spiritual life. Bhagavatam is the expansion of the Bhagavad Gita. So you know, Prabhupada knew that he had limited time. So he picked those essential books to get them out. But he also gave instructions, we'll probably read about this tomorrow morning. He also gave some instructions about books that he, other books that he would like to see produced, which he knew he wouldn't be able to do. Yeah. Padma Purana, Vishnu Purana, like this, other books. But we are, you know, he said these four books in the old days, it was Nectar of Devotion, Bhagavad Gita, Teachings of Lord Chaitanya, and the Srimad Bhagavatam. He said if you understand those four books, you don't need to know anything else. That's all. Don't be worried about so many other books. Yeah. When you've read all the Bhagavatam, and you've read the whole Chaitanya Charitamrita, and all the Bhagavad Gita, and you've understood them, then think about other books. But if you haven't read those books, and already you're talking about other books, what's the use? Yeah? Yes?
What would please Prabhupada know Harinam Sankirtan or book distribution?
What would please Prabhupada more, Harinam or book distribution? I have to say that both of them are very pleasing, but more pleasing is book distribution. In the early days of the movement, you know, going out on Harinam, that was our only activity. We didn't have many books. You know, up until the mid-70s, there really weren't that many books. And because we had Back to Godhead magazines, we used to sell those. But at least when I joined in 72 in Sydney, the daily activity for all the devotees was to just go out for 6 hours a day and chant. We'd go up and down the street, we'd stand on the street corners, we'd get chased by the police. we'd be chanting. We had a lot of fun, it was great. I remember, I joined the Sydney Temple, there were 10 devotees in the temple at that time. I think there were only about 10 or 12 devotees in the whole of Australia at that time. At least the Sydney Temple had about 10 or 12. There were a few that had blooped, but there was no temple in Melbourne or anywhere else. There was when I joined. When I first met the devotees, there wasn't. When I joined the temple, they'd just opened a new temple here in Melbourne, and there were about 5 or 6 devotees. So you could say there was maybe about 20 devotees in the whole place. And all we would do was just go out and chant. And, you know, then stand on one street corner, maybe for 3 or 4 hours. And of course, all the office workers that have to be working on that street corner, they get very agitated. You know, these people are singing and banging drums and, you know, banging cymbals like this for hours and hours. It's driving us crazy. So, you know, when I first joined, that's what we used to do. We'd just stand there for hours on end in the same spot. But then the police started getting a lot of complaints. So, you know, after a while, and I joined in February of 72. By April, when Prabhupada came, only 6 weeks later, we'd gone from 12 devotees to about 44 living in the temple. We'd go out every couple of days, there'd be somebody new sitting on the doorstep when we came back from Sankirtan. So we went from 12 to 44 like within a few weeks. So the Sankirtan party, you know, increased accordingly. So sometimes we'd go out on Pitt Street, we'd stand in front of Woolworths, and we'd all line up, 25 or 30 of us in a line, and we'd all start chanting, Namah Om Vishnu Padaya. And we'd all start swaying, and you know, we'd be there in our saffron robes and saris and dhotis like this. And then all of a sudden, within about 5 or 10 minutes, a police, you know, wagon would come flying around the corner. And we'd all look, we'd watch them come around the corner. And then we would wonder, you know, are they going to stop or are they going to go on? And then all of a sudden they'd screech to a halt in front, all the cops would jump out the van, and we'd run. So you get like 25 devotees running in every direction. We'd go running through, you know, Myers and Woolworths, and cops would be running after us. I remember running in Myers, and we went up the escalators, we were running through the, you know, the ladies' fashion area there, and you're running up the after, the cops are running up after us, hide behind the rest of clothes. It was a lot of fun. And usually they catch one or two people. They'd always catch Dwapiana, because Dwapiana used to play his guitar, and he wasn't a very fast runner, so they'd always get him. And whoever was playing the mridanga, he would also they'd all catch him. So, it got to a point where we were really tremendously harassed. And it got very difficult. You couldn't even set foot on the street sometimes. One devotee got arrested just for going out on the street. You know, the cops were so agitated with it. All right, here's a Hare Krishna, arrest him. You know. So it got a little difficult. We tried different tactics. We instead of having one big group in one spot, then we broke up two devotees on each crossroads. So one devotee would sail back to Godhead, the other devotee would play the same, the kartans. And then after half an hour, we'd switch around. So we had devotees everywhere, all over the city. Then we started getting harassed for that. Anyway, it went on for some months. But at about the same time, different books started, getting produced and being shipped over from Los Angeles. And it was in 1972 when the devotees really discovered how to sell Prabhupada's books. Previously, we'd been selling a few back to Godhead. Then they discovered how to sell big books on the street. And we had one devotee, Buddy Mountain. He came from America. And he was one of the leaders in book distribution. He was a very, very potent man. Young guy, tall, and totally infectious enthusiasm. And he trained everybody up how to go out and sell Prabhupada's books. So at one point, there was a bit of a debate, whether we should be selling books or chanting Hare Krishna. So letters were sent to Srila Prabhupada to ask him. And then Prabhupada confirmed. He said, book distribution is more important. He said, that's also kirtan. Yeah, don't think that it's not kirtan. This is the, Brihat Mridanga. You can play a mridanga, it will go for one or two city blocks. But this book, this is the Brihat Mridanga, this is the big mridanga, this will go all over the world. So Prabhupada began to emphasize the selling of his books more than doing Hari Nam. And within a very short period, late 72, early 73, all the temples in the world practically changed over from chanting to doing book distribution. Of course, then once we started selling books, we got even more harassed by the cops. I remember in 73, we all were here in Melbourne, we had Nectar Devotions. We got 25,000 Nectar Devotions or something. So we had to sell them. And we had this Krishna Trilogy softbound. Amaga had been the temple president, so in a spirit of enthusiasm and competition, he'd ordered like 40,000 books or something. And we had a place in Little Lonsdale Street, warehouse. And there were all the books are simply sitting there. And if somebody went out and sold one Nectar of Devotion or a couple of Krishna books, that was like an amazing thing. Because we didn't know what to do with them. Then Buddy Mantra came. Yeah, we had all those books there for a year, and nobody could sell any of them, and everybody was cursing the Margaret for loading us up with this burden. And then Buddy Mantra came in February of 1973. He came down here to Melbourne with a small party, about four or five men. Madam Lisa Swami was the GBC. He came with him. In 2 months, we sold the entire stock of books. Everything, 40,000 books gone in 2 months. Yeah. I mean, Buddy was a real amazing character. And we all got caught up in it. So, we were out in the street. You go walk down, you get down at Flinders Street Station. You walk up the block there, up to Burke Street. You'd meet about at least 8 devotees on the way up. And every one of them would hit you up. So all around the city blocks, we had about 18 devotees out on the street selling books. So naturally, within a very short period, then the council, you know, took exception to that, and then they started harassing us. And they would book out, they would book us. We were trying to sell books to them, but they would come and book us. anyway, it's a long history. You know, we had a lot of fun. Sometimes we'd go to jail. People would be arrested, or you'd see a devotee running down the street with a council officer running at you. You know, the cops there. it was great. But the point was that, you know, we got into book distribution because Prabhupada said that was more important. So, out of the two, they're both important, but yeah, books are definitely more valuable. Prabhupada was much more pleased with that. And by, you know, 1973-74, Australia was actually we were the top book distributors in the world. We were beating all the temples in America. We only had about 45 devotees in the whole yatra between Sydney and Melbourne and Adelaide. But we were outselling everybody in the whole world. That was why Prabhupada came to the Rath Yatra to Melbourne in 1974. He told Madhavisa, he said, "I'll come if you are the top book distributors. Yeah, otherwise I'm not going to come." So Prabhupada would deliberately promote competition between the temples, you know, to increase it. So, yeah, if you want to please Prabhupada, sell some books. Alright? Any other questions?
Oh, my friend's got a Hare Krishna book, and I think that was right.
Yes.
You always knew that where the Hare Krishna books were, they had a fluorescent cover.
Yeah, we had, the Nectar of Devotion was a hot pink, and the Krishna book was like a translucent blue, like pale blue. And that was what we had. We were selling, you know, Nectar Devotions and soft-band Krishna books. It was great. You had some amazing experiences on Sankirtan sometimes. I remember I was forced to go on Buddy Master's traveling party. Because, you know, I was kind of... Personally, I never really got into book distribution that much. I hated going out on the street, I have to admit it. But we did it because Prabhupada wanted it. So I was forced to go out with Buddy Mansa on a traveling party to Adelaide. Then, you know, we were there for a couple of weeks. We sold a lot of books, and then we were on the way back into Melbourne. And I'd been asleep in the van. And they pulled into this petrol station. So Buddy Mansa decided this was a good opportunity to sell a book. So, you know, he woke me up and he threw me out the van, almost literally, and he stuck a Bhagavad Gita, half-bound Bhagavad Gita, into my hands. He said, "Go and sell this book, Harry Sori." Like this. And then, you know, the guy that owned the petrol station, he was there in the office, he said, "Go and sell him this book. Don't come back till you've done it." Well, I just woke up, you know, I was completely in the mood of being like, off I go, and I was thinking, what am I going to do with this? How am I going to sell this? So I walked in, and just as I walked in, the guy walked out. So I was thinking, now what am I going to do? So I see there's this long-haired guy there, and he's just kind of hanging around. So I went up to him, I said, "You know, where did the guy go?" He said, "Oh, I just went out." I said, "Well, I was supposed to give him this book." I said, "You may as well have it." So I dropped the, you know, Gita into this guy's hands. And I just started talking to him. I said, "What do you do?" He said, "Well, actually," he said, "I grow vegetables up in the Adelaide Hills." So I said, "Oh, far out." And I opened the Bhagavad Gita up. And it opened on the page where Krishna says, "I become, you know, the moon and give life to the vegetables." It was amazing. I'd never even seen that verse myself. he just opened it up and there it was. And I said, "Dad, look, see, this is about Krishna, how he gives life to the vegetables." And he went, "Oh, far out, man." Like this. So I said, "Okay," I said, "you know, so you should take that." He said, "Well, how much is it?" I said, "Just give $5. So he gave the money and off I went. And I came back and I sold it. Woody Master was amazed. He actually didn't believe I was going to do it. So I had some nice experiences on Sankirtan. And if you really want to you know, experience the real nectar of Krishna consciousness. Just go out, you know, on the street and sell some books. It's tough. It's really tough sometimes. But when you actually get a sale, you know, it's so much ecstasy. Another example, last example. I sold a Krishna book to some drunk guy. Right. I just did it because he was drunk, so I figured he didn't know what he was doing. I gave some money. So I sold him this Krishna book. And then the next day, he comes staggering, he's drunk again. He comes staggering down Swanson Street. And he stopped. And he said, hey, he said, that book you gave me. He said, how am I supposed to believe that somebody can tear somebody else in half? He'd read about, you know, Jarasandha. So he read the whole story. They sat there reading. He said, how am I supposed to believe that? Nobody could do that, something like that. But it was in his mind, you know. He'd read the Krishna book. I was in ecstasy. I thought, this is great. Even the drunkard, you know, he'd made an impression on his mind that he's not going to forget. All right, any other questions? Manager, how are you?
Good.
All right, nice to see you.
I was wondering, you said that you saw Kapitanjan copies of Nacharya Varsha in 2 months. I was just wondering if you just gave it to them, or
No. How did we sell 40,000 books in 2 months? Did we give them away? No, we didn't. Prabhupada was against that.
Yes.
He said, I don't want Bible selling. Yeah? You know, you go and stay in a hotel, every drawer there's a Gideon's Bible or something, you know? The Prabhupada said, I don't want that. He said they have to be sold, because if a person pays the money, then he'll at least he'll think, well, what have I paid my money for? And he'll look and he'll read it. But if you just give them away because it's cheap, you know, they've obtained it cheaply, then they'll take it cheaply also, they'll just toss it away. So we used to sell everything. Prabhupada was very insistent on that. When my parents came to see me in London on this last world tour, I had left England in 1971. I emigrated. I met the devotees as soon as I arrived in Sydney, and I joined at the beginning of 72. Then, of course, I wrote back to my parents, and one of the friends that I'd come over with, I'd emigrated with, he had returned to England. He was one of my best friends. He lived nearby my house. So he went back and he showed them, you know, my parents, his pictures of me with a bald head and, you know, robes. So they thought I'd gone mad. I mean, literally. They weren't far wrong, but they thought I'd gone crazy, and they were writing, you know, we have to get you out of the clutches of these people. We're going to get the police to come and rescue you and all this kind of stuff. These people are in, you're in this evil cult and all this stuff. And I was writing back to them, well, actually, you know, I'm not this body, so you're not really my parents. We had a few acrimonious exchanges. It got to the point where I wrote to my father, and he rarely wrote, but he wrote me this letter, and it was really not nice. And so I wrote back to him. I said, look, I said, if you ever blaspheme the devotees again, you're never going to hear from me ever again. So then he wrote back. He said, all right, we won't say anything. And then I agreed, all right, I won't preach to you. So that was the agreement. They wouldn't criticize the devotees, and I wouldn't preach. And then we got on fine. You know, the weather's nice, I'm healthy, blah, 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 like that. Now we're happy with that. So, 1976, I returned to England, but with Prabhupada as his servant. So they hadn't seen me for 5 years. They all came to Bhaktivedanta Manor, and they liked it. They loved it. You know, they saw the devotees out in the lawns chanting. I took them around. They saw the deities, you know, the big manor. Of course, George Harrison had given us that place, so that was also very impressive. So they, you know, they liked it, and they were pleased to see that I was happy also, because I wasn't happy when I left England. There's in England they have this saying, if somebody's kind of very disgruntled and unhappy, oh, he's got a chip on his shoulder. Yeah, comes from the old, I guess the mines or whatever, you have a wood chip, a big burden on your shoulder, and you're up there, weighed down. So my mum said, when you left, you had a big chip on your shoulder. Yeah. And then when they saw me with Prabhupada, I was very happy and bright, and you know, they were very satisfied with that. They saw I was transformed. So anyway, at one point, you know, I showed them the Bhagavad Gita. I've been doing a bit of preaching and explaining the philosophy. And I sold them the Bhagavad Gita. You know, my mum and my brother, they kind of paid half and half each, and they took it home with them. So that was the spirit, you know. We were always in this mood of selling Prabhupada's books. Yeah, we didn't like to give them away at all. Because later on, because of harassments that we got, we had to withdraw from the street after a few years. Then we had to adopt different tactics to get the books out again. We started earning money from other means, selling paraphernalia. And then we were still, you know, getting large amounts of books printed, so we did start giving them away at one point. But that was only because of the circumstances. But the better thing is to sell them, and then people will appreciate it. Any other questions? Oh, there is. Who distributes books? Put your hands up. Anything to distribute to?
No, they're not putting their hands up, but they went out and we had 34 devotees went out in the Prabhupada Hanuman.
34?
Yeah. Five of them were full time,
uh-huh.
But the rest were made up of quite a few devotees who were not putting their hands up now.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you, Prabhupada got endless pleasure from those Christmas marathons. You know, the idea of a Christmas marathon kind of evolved once we got into book distribution as a society-wide activity. Then it didn't take very long for the devotees to realize that at Christmas time people had more money and they were in a better mood and they were more inclined to buy. So the devotees started with a three-day marathon, you know, like 3 days before Christmas. And they would stay out all day and night practically because the shops were all packed, late night shopping everywhere, so they would just stay out and they saw it was a good opportunity. So within a very short period that became, you know, like a week long marathon. And in 1976, just in that 1 week before Christmas in America, they sold something like 600,000 big books. And a couple of million back to Godheads. Mm-hmm. I mean, huge amounts of literature just in that 1 week. So the Christmas marathon became, you know, one of the main activities of the year for the book distributors. Mm-hmm. They would literally stay out all night long. I remember on a Saturday sometimes when we were in Double Bay, we had the temple there. We would, and Woody Manta was there. We would go out on a Saturday morning about 7:30 or 8 o'clock, we would be on the street and we had different spots. So in the morning time, when there was, in those days it was half day shopping, so we would do all morning in Pitt Street, George Street, like that in Sydney. Then in the afternoon there were all the movie lines, so we'd move from the street to the movie lines and we'd go up and down the movie lines and sell books there. And then in the evening, when all the shops were closed, then we would move over to King's Cross. And then we would stay in King's Cross until about 3:30 in the morning. Because there was always people out there. And we'd stay out there 3 o'clock, 3:30 in the morning. We'd get back to the temple just in time for Mangalarati. And we'd go to Mangalarati and then we would go and take rest. So we'd been out, you know, like almost 24 hours. But, you know, there was just a lot of enthusiasm for selling for our clients' books, and he very, very much appreciated it. You know, he said, you know, if my books are selling, I will live forever. That was what he told us. So it's good if you like to sell for our clients' books, or even if you don't like to sell for our clients' books, do it anyway. Because Prabhupada likes you to sell his books. Any other questions? Okay, it's getting a little late, it's 10 to 10. So we'll finish at this point. Tomorrow morning we'll continue on. 7:30 until 9. Everybody's invited if you can make it. And I believe these recordings are also being put on the website. So if you want to download that and listen to them, you're quite welcome. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.